Hello, and welcome to the Misadventures in Marketing podcast, presented by the American Marketing Association San Francisco chapter. I'm Steve Haney, a fractional go-to-market executive in Silicon Valley.
And I'm Peter Farrago, a high-tech marketer in the Bay Area. Each week, Steve and I come together to discuss all things in high-tech marketing.
We share our own experiences running marketing teams with a special focus on technology startups. We talk about our successes, our failures, what worked and what didn't. Every once in a while, we're inviting our CMO friends and other marketing colleagues onto the show, and hopefully we will impart some wisdom along the way. Peter, it's been about 1 year since we started this podcast. Can you believe it?
We have an anniversary. Nice.
Yeah. Maybe
happy
this
anniversary,
is
anniversary, Steve.
A happy anniversary. It's been so what is it? For the 1 year,
I have to give you a gift in paper.
Yes, some kind of paper gift. So, Peter, what is the tech news item this week that you think's most interesting?
I think what's interesting is that the federal government, Trump's organization, has just signed an executive order where the federal government would sue any state that is trying to curb the development of AI. And it's in, you know, it's a little bit of a heavy-handed style that our government seems to be dealing with, federal versus state. But it's, I think the underlying concern is that China has got more R&D in AI than us, and we could lose some kind of AI race. It's trying to relax, you know, constraints around, you know, innovation around a certain sector that folks feel is going to be an economic battleground globally.
Right. Your general thought is this is broadly a good thing because this will be challenged in court.
Politics aside, I think you need the room for innovation, and you, I don't want a bad outcome. I don't want like plants, you know, factories polluting the river kind of thing, right? Like, so, you know, there is energy consumption. There are energy consumption concerns with environmental concerns with AI, but with the consumption of, you know, for all the GPU stuff. But generally, on the whole, I agree with letting innovation happen and not trying to put brakes on constraints on it.
Right. Well, I think everybody is still gun shy because we didn't do it with social media, and it's led to a lot of adverse effects around misinformation and teenage suicide. And so I think people are trying to be a bit cautious. Okay, we've got this new technology wave. We don't want to make the same mistakes. We want to make sure that, you know, we're putting the right guardrails in place from the beginning and trying to think out these scenarios. That being said, you know, I don't think anybody anticipated Facebook on a smartphone and the whole phenomenon of doom scrolling. So even back then, if you had put all those regulations on and tried to think out all the scenarios to make social media non-destructive, I don't think anybody, it's hard to anticipate the future. And this is always the case with regulation, right? If you try to anticipate what the use of, but regulation on information technology, right? High tech. When you try to imagine the scenarios, they always turn out to be completely different, right? And I think this even goes back to the Microsoft case and the breakup back in whatever it was, late 80s, early 90s, where, you know, everybody was worried about Microsoft. And then, of course, the iPhone came in and just completely wiped out the PC as anything relevant in terms of the computing landscape. And, of course, the web as well. So, well, for me, I think most interesting tech news as of late is Disney investing $1 billion in OpenAI and licensing their characters for their, I don't know what to call it. I call it a video editing suite, but their video AI product called Sora, I believe.
Yep.
And so, yeah, you'll be able to use Sora to go in and create animated movies featuring Daffy Duck and Mickey Mouse and Elsa from Frozen. And, you know, I'm just wondering this melding of Hollywood / content with these AI firms and how those relationships are going to work. And, you know, talk about guardrails. right? I'm sure that they're putting all kinds of guardrails around this deal to ensure that, you know, Mickey Mouse is used appropriately in the aforementioned videos that are generated. So, you know, I think this is kind of a landmark deal. I think it's really fascinating, and it's going to be interesting how it turns out.
It feels like Disney is being progressive in acknowledging that there's this new way their IP can get used with or without their participation. And it sounds like they're trying to make sure they can monetize that IP in a new channel, and that they're kind of just getting ahead of it. It's not quite like Napster was with the music industry, where there was like peer-to-peer sharing of the music, because this is actually creating new content with existing characters more easily. It's less like just taking the final work and distributing it differently without royalties or licensing fees or just monetization period. It's interesting.
And our next segment, How I AI. So, myself, I've been really diving into the AI tools in Canva, and I have to say, I am not impressed at all getting it to generate even the most basic graphics for me or helping me lay out a piece. It's just not great. Compared to, say, using Gemini 3 and Veo in Google Slides. And, you know, I think Canva has a lot of work to do in this respect. So, you know, those are the tools I've been exploring lately. And, you know, can't say I've been super impressed, but, you know, the folks at Canva, they're brilliant. They've got a brilliant product. And, you know, I'm sure just in good time, they'll be able to catch up and make it work more the way folks want it to work. How about you?
Yeah, the Canva thing, I've been using Canva a lot, and when their AI stuff, their magic, whatever came out, it's been an evolution. They were early, so there's kind of early tools. There's an expand one that's not bad, but it gives you a bunch of weirdness on the edges if you're trying to change the ratio, aspect ratio of something. The one I find myself using most there is honestly just like magic. It's like magic edit, I think, or magic erase. It's like it will blend something. So you can clean up images. You can basically separate layers pretty easily with magic grab. So I kind of use it for some manipulation, last mile manipulation with stuff. I don't use it for initial generation either. The imagery is not great. What I was going to say was, for my tip, is I may have said this before, but there's a lot of prompt engineering people are like putting out there, like, oh, say it this way and say it that way. I just think treat AI like your collaborative thought partner and try to engage it in iterative conversational prompting. And I would say try to keep a subject or a topic per chat, like in GPT, for example. I think in Anthropic, I'm finding with Claude, it seems to have a better, it might, I haven't verified this, but it seems to understand like different conversations that have been happening and pulling that together in a unified knowledge base. But I would say like try to keep it around a theme. For example, like if I'm doing a lot of social media posting for my company, I have like the LinkedIn, you know, stuff, because there's a bunch of little things that have to be right. The first two sentences have to have stopping power because of the way the post shows, it's kind of, you know, it's like an accordion thing. So it's just showing the line. You got to click more to open it. So those first two sentences matter. And, you know, there's different formats. So I kind of have taught it to do a certain set of things that's specific, and I keep it around, you know, a theme or a topic or a process. And so that's what I would say. If you think of it like a person and you're trying to give that person enough context, because that's what it needs. It needs the context. Yes. You don't have to say like, you are a professional something, and you've been asked to do the following. You can be a little more, hey, I'm trying to do this. We're planning this. You know, this is the situation. Here's what we have so far. That works for me the best. And it helps me think through things, especially if you're like, I like to have a sounding board. I like to collaborate in general. And so I do find that this is a strong proxy for a lot of that. You still have to like realize when the conversation's drifting, there's like drift that happens where you're like, oh, somehow in the iteration, we've kind of started going in a weird direction and we've lost the plot. So you do have to pay attention to that. But that's my tip, is just, it's your collaborative thought partner. Just think of it as such. And that then you'll find you're using it for lots of things.
Yeah, I know that a lot of people are so adverse to this idea of anthropomorphizing, you know, but you're absolutely right. I think to get the most out of them and create something worthwhile, you really do have to approach it in that manner, that this is, you know, it may be, you know, it's artificial, you know, it doesn't have the sophistication of a human, but if you don't approach it in the manner that, you know, this is an entity that I interact with as a partner or a co-pilot, right? You're not going to be as productive with these tools. I really do think you have to think about it.
Yep.
That way. So, Peter, what are we talking about today in our main segment?
Today we're talking about a great topic, which is kind of how you figure out as a company what's going to work in marketing, and especially when you're starting small and from a cold start.
Yeah. What are those marketing channels that actually produce for you? What is the mix? How do you experiment with new ones, et cetera?
And the messiness and anxiety of trying to figure it out, because there's no easy way. It's hard for a lot of reasons. I think one of it is expectations. You know, oftentimes when I'm in a small company, I've been through it before, but others haven't. It's probably a chronic problem with marketing is educating your colleagues. We're also just kind of setting expectations appropriately about what's going to work and what's not going to work. And then you get into the reality of the cost of certain things. Then really you're picking from a free menu and you're trying to try a lot of stuff and you don't have a team. It's like sort of the hardest thing, because every marketing, call it plan, is different at every company to some extent based on a bunch of factors. And also even at the same company, things can change meaningfully year over year around what you're doing. And there are people who are sort of professional journeymen, journey people, demand gen people, and they tend to like fall into buckets of, you know, either it's one sort of general function is PR, maybe not like what people traditionally think of as demand gen, but then they think of paid media like advertising, or they think of SEO, right? So there are some things that can be applied right size, but applied as sort of tactics or programs across channels, across companies, individual companies. So I don't know, like it's a mix. On the one hand, look, you've got let's say B2B, you know, you've got like social channels, you got email, you've got paid advertising, you've got PR, you've got events, you know, SEO, SEM, content. Like these are all, you know, every company talks about having something like that, you know. So that's in common. But what works will be different for sure.
Obviously, early on, the old Paul Graham notion of at the beginning, you do things that aren't scalable, right? You're just being scrapey out there, going out and spending a lot of money on programmatic advertising is not a wise move, right? So I think especially in B2B events, right? If you have some kind of email database, you know, leveraging that as much as possible. You know, obviously you want to continue to generate content. We've talked a lot about hoping that you have a CEO who's willing to be on the social media channels and very engaged. You really can't do that as a head of marketing, because nobody wants to hear from the marketing guy, right, on social media. They want to hear from the founders and the CEO. And, you know, that's just a blessing if you can get it, because a lot of, you know, at least tech CEOs do not want to engage in that kind of constant online presence. But it's really, really important. And I think you'll, if you talk to any marketer of in startup marketing in the Valley today, they will absolutely agree with you 1,000% on this. And then, you know, just work those existing channels and get the content out there. And then, you know, much later, you can go to start experimenting. And, you know, again, as you and I have discussed, kind of the traditional AdWords, Facebook, LinkedIn, advertising channels, they're just, it's very hard to justify them. You know, your customer acquisition costs are so high, you've got to keep that customer around for years for it to make sense. You know, I think average kind of B2B tech marketing, and this is a very broad estimate, customer acquisition cost is, you know, anywhere from $200 to $300. And if you've got, you know, like an entry level offering of $99 per seat per month, very hard to justify that kind of thing. But what we used to call, like, you know, the trade press now has moved pretty much to podcasts and to Substack newsletters or any kind of industry-specific newsletters from these influencers. So all of a sudden you're working with influencers, and there may be, you know, in your particular vertical, you know, 5 to 10 critical podcasters or 5 to 10 critical Substackers. And, you know, those are the channels that you want to get on that still have a reasonable cost that makes sense to target and push your message towards. So, you know, I think just in terms of that early channel experimentation, that's really the direction you want to go. And then, you know, the question becomes, you know, how much of this do you want to kind of keep to yourself, so to speak, like your email marketing and your own blog and, you know, your own social media channels? And, you know, how much of this do you want to put into these other platforms? You know, I always go back to the Penguin Google algorithm revision back in, I think it was in, yeah, the teens, where it was just a titanic shift for a number of industries. And Google literally just wiped out certain businesses in certain geographies because they completely turned the algorithm on its head. I don't know what it's like lately. You know, I think they're more sensitive and cognitive of these kind of major shifts like that. But the question, if you're a startup, if you've become so dependent on one platform to generate leads or generate business, do you want to risk TikTok changing their algorithm or Facebook changing their algorithm, and all of a sudden your demand just drops through the floor? I don't know if you ever faced that. How have you handled it?
I want to own the relationship. I want to own the outreach. So everything's about getting people back to my site and then getting their email address, so I have an install base. And I need that. I do look at reach, like our LinkedIn following and our size of our Instagram or Facebook or social media company accounts, let's say. I do look at that as reach or individual folks, but it's more about getting the word out. Those are channels to get the word out and broadcast out things. But I still want people to come back to the site, and I still want to start a relationship with them there and nurture track there. Like, I got to capture their email somehow.
Yeah. Well, one of the things I didn't hear you talking about was events. You know, certainly at the big companies, right? We go to these gigantic trade shows, and I think both you and I have done, you know, these multi-hundred-thousand-dollar trade show booths and, you know, just the whole thing. But at an earlier stage startup, I am now a big fan of just having one of those crappy little tables. You know, you pay $1,000, $2,000 for them. You've got your sign up there and you're just pressing the flesh. You know, I think it's incredibly important, and you have, you know, you have a concentrated collection of people who are interested in your stuff, because, you know, you should only be going to these highly specialized, highly focused little conferences. Hopefully, you're speaking there, right? Your CEO is going to be talking, and people are going to be coming to your table, not even a booth, just the table is fine. And I think you, to kind of get back to what you were saying about content, right? Okay, so the thing's not going to go viral and be everywhere, but you need to have those base components in place for the people who do come to your website and do read the blog posts, and they're getting informed about your product. Same thing with the events. You know, again, going back to the, you know, the quote about doing the hard, non-scalable stuff before you get to the scalable stuff, Paul Graham. You know, events are definitely in no way scalable. I remember, again, early in my career, being with smaller companies and, you know, would have a sales rep in a certain region, and there was a, you know, a mid-size, significant trade show. But for budgetary reasons or whatever, we couldn't afford to go again. And, or even, you know, a higher level trade show among like the 10 key ones that you have to focus on in your vertical, and not showing up to one or two for budgetary reasons or whatever. And the sales rep's coming back to say, like, if we don't show up to these shows, people don't think we exist. And I would just say, what are you talking about? You know, we've got the website, we're doing email marketing, you know, we've got our ad spend. How could they, you know, we've got these product launches that we're promoting, you know, how could they not know we exist? And I, you know, I've learned my lesson, and I've understood that, you know, if you're not there, IRL, as the kids used to say, you know, in real life, then it matters. So that's one of those non-scalable things that I think, for an early stage startup belongs in the mix as well, is you just gotta show up physically, and, you know, make that part of that, you know, what you said, like the cold start, 0 to 50 million or even 0 to 10 million, marketing mix to succeed.
Building those relationships, being at trade shows matters, and then you can layer on the other stuff. So around it, you know, content, big content drops and so on. But my main point is you got to do that in combination. It's not going to be one thing. It's going to be like events plus maybe speaking, thought leadership and content, or, you know what I mean? Like, it's just got to be stuff. And everybody knows, okay, you got to do case studies. I had an interview years ago and someone was like, offended that I didn't mention case studies. And it's like, yeah, of course you do. I mean, of course you do case studies. Like, does that need to be said? It's like, if you can get a company that had a good experience with your product, you're going to document it, right? Like, obviously it's a proof point, but you know, so you're going to do all that. I'm trying not to leave things out. You're going to do all that. You're going to get social proof. You're going to get like third-party validation. If you need to work with analysts in your industry, you're going to do that. Like the Gartners and the Foresters and stuff. You're going to do all that. You got to show up at the events. But that goes back to, I guess I want to ask you, are we trying to figure out something that's different for every company, or are there certain playbooks and there's a certain set of activities you have to do in combination plus put your own spin on?
Yeah. Like I said, I think it all becomes very organic. You know, you're going to take the same building blocks that you've always understood and you know how to play them, but every product I've ever gone in to sell them, it's a completely different dynamic. And it's not just the product's slightly different from the last, you know, bug tracker or, you know, AI QA platform. you know, it's you're just selling a different thing every time. What doesn't change is understanding, the ideal, the ICP and the personas within the ICP. And, but then the question comes, this is a completely different, you know, approach, even though the product is similar. Basically, the end goals of the products may be the same, but the way they do the job they've been hired for is different. Therefore, the marketing is different. Therefore, the marketing channels are sometimes vastly different. And the mixes within them. I mean, early on, I was always down on LinkedIn because, you know, the ads, you remember this, I'm sure, early on were way more expensive and just didn't perform. And because most tech executives are on LinkedIn, you know, the CEOs would always come to me and say, we got to do something on LinkedIn. I said, well, okay, but I can show you how, you know, AdWords performs better, or we should put our money into events. They perform better. Right. You want me to do a $20,000 spend on LinkedIn? We could take that money and we could go to three regional trade shows and generate a lot more demand. And, you know, the sales guys will love us, yada, yada, yada. But now, you know, it's a well-performing channel. I mean, you know, it does much better than it did back then. And so the time changes. And then, you know, I would find that even during that time, there were certain products that the company, for some reason, or the products were already established on LinkedIn. The point I'm trying to make is it's organic and different in every company, every time. And, you know, having these new channels pop up, and this is a really interesting question I'd love to get your thoughts on. And I know I've mentioned this before, but advertising on, you know, the what would you call it? Vertical video native platforms. So the TikToks of the world, although everybody's got vertical video now, you know, and introducing this new element into the mix, how do you approach that? Because, you know, classically it's kind of, you know, 70% on your known channels that work, 20% on, you know, channels that are kind of established, but you're working on, and then 10% on the shiny new object and taking that part of your budget and, like, say, going to TikTok and say, can I make B2B marketing work on this channel, which, you know, obviously seems very consumer, but, you know, you have to experiment. How have you approached that traditionally?
So you can do that two ways. You can do it. I actually like this idea, especially for LinkedIn. They're called thought leadership ads. To me, I like that because it's at the intersection of brand and demand. And what we would do is first have really good content from an individual, a founder. Two of our founders are professors. The other two are also have their PhDs or PhDs. And so they can come up with some really good content. So the first thing is understand your audience, come up with some really good content. And then push that out from a personal account, a founder marketing play, not from the company account on LinkedIn in this case, vertical video format. It's you know, native vertical video. It's exactly what you described it as. And then you basically would try this thought leadership ad, which will put the specific ad or this video that we created that's actually organic content in front of the right people on LinkedIn, you know, like you're right. And that's something that I like as a test because it maps back to, I don't know if it's a hypothesis or now it's just kind of a known thing. It's like thought leadership's going to make a difference for us because we have people who are thought leadership oriented and our industry calls for showing people the way. I think we're creating a little bit. So that all sort of, we're a candidate for that. We think it works. Our founders are interested enough in doing that. And then I can like have a layer of that kind of content. So everything should have a purpose. And another way I think about marketing that I probably said many times, and I didn't invent this, but there are other ways to say this, but I think of them as assets and distribution. Some people think about it as fuel and engine, but basically you got to make something and then you got to get other people to see it. So in this case, I like the content piece, the assets we're making. Then it's about like, okay, if you spend a lot of time making something cool, valuable, interesting, maybe there's production budget behind it to create it, you know, with editing and maybe outsource it. You need to get people to see that. And this is the challenge I think today that I'm running into is distribution on assets is harder right now. It's harder than it's been. We're more concentrated in a few channels and they're noisier. And organic by itself may not be enough. You may have to do a combination of paid and organic. It seems harder to rank for things now, you know, and I, you know, it's getting high quality backlinks is harder. Something is messy right now. And I think in those situations, I go back to some fundamentals, like we need to create something compelling and useful for our audience that resonates, you know, and that's very vague, but and it's going to be different for every company and every audience, but that's what we have to do. And then we have to find ways to get those assets in front of them. Could be trade show speaking. It could be a guest article in an outlet if those exist much. It could be Substack newsletters. Try to get on the right podcast. Maybe we have a message, kind of messaging plan per quarter or something. But we have to make these big bets on something contrarian or compelling. And then we have to like build campaigns around it where we try to push the distribution on it and measure that. And so I'm doing it judiciously. I do love what you just, maybe you just picked it out of the air, but I love that thought leadership video ad format on LinkedIn as an idea for us, because I think it fits with how we're trying to build our brand and get the right kind of attention from the right people.
I'm not a big TikTok user, but vertical video on all the traditional social media platforms does become addictive. I recently became a YouTube premium subscriber, and I highly recommend this because it completely changes your YouTube experience. And now, right at the top of the app, whenever I open it, they're feeding me like 6 vertical videos. And it does become, you know, I know it's bad, but if it's so bad, Peter, why does it make me feel so good? Just, you know, all you just flip and it's great. And every once in a while, one of them's an ad with a 10-second thought leadership thing from some founder about something the algorithm has fed up to you. So yeah, it's compelling and it's interesting and it gets the brand in front of you. And it also takes advantage of the fact that, you know, if you're lucky, you've got 5 to 10 seconds to make your pitch in front of somebody doom scrolling. Don't you think you need to go to where the people are? Why do you think that after 5 o'clock, you know, your prospects just are turned off to whatever, and they're not going to other, they go to Instagram, they go to Facebook, they go to TikTok.
It's an interesting question. I'd say that, like, do I go to the places where people hang out? It's like, eventually, yes, I'm going to go everywhere at scale. But when you're starting, you know, you probably are starting with the places that are going to be easily, like the easily identified to be more targeted. But I'd say, like, for example, I can pull the top N number of podcasts and I could try to pitch organically my folks to be on there, or I can think about ads, you know. There's something probably more on the observability industry, and then there's more general tech like TLDR. Like, which one do I go after? I probably go for the niche first. Same with these Substack newsletters. There's literally something called SCR Weekly. It's like, okay, well, that one's super targeted. Then the question for me becomes, is that a day-to-day practitioner, or is that the leader decision maker of the engineering team? So then I have a thing about buying committee. Am I reaching my decision maker? Am I reaching day-to-day end users, or do I care right now? So my point is, I'm going to start like concentric circles. I'm going to target the bullseye with like a little bit pure, where I think I can reach people in events and newsletters and podcasts and whatever. So I think the bottom line is you've got to be willing to test something systematically and try to measure it. But it should start with, call it common sense, you know, what works for your audience, what works for the type of company you can become. In my case, thought leadership and so on. And it's a little bit of, I'd say, taste and common sense and a little bit of like trying to measure directionally at least and go from there. So I it's not magic. I think the last thing I'll say is it's better to do something than do nothing.
Yes, absolutely. How about I read us out?
Please do, sir.
We want to thank you, our audience, for listening to Misadventures in Marketing. Our editors, Lorenzo Fernandez-Kopek at Peak Bound Studio and Brian Douglas at The Creative Comms, for making us sound and look great. We want to thank our marketing maven, Ian Robertson Lambert, for getting the word out. Julianne Bernales for being our consulting producer. Renita Dada for driving our market research and the content calendar. And of course, Thomas Moyer, president of AMA San Francisco, for presenting this podcast. We'd also like to thank our sponsor, Workbox, for their support of Misadventures in Marketing.